The Big Journey from Creation to New Creation. This is a Bible teaching series that will take you all the way through the Bible, from the creation account in Genesis to John's vision of the new creation in the book of Revelation. This series is brought to you by creationtonewcreation.com. In our last talk, we looked at why God made mankind. God gave Adam and Eve and their descendants the task of completing his work of creation. They were to extend the borders of the Garden of Eden and make the whole earth a paradise, a place where mankind would live in God's presence. But Adam and Eve's walk with God in paradise didn't last. There came a day when they rebelled against him. The terrifying consequences of that rebellion confront us daily in a thousand ways. Things are not the way they ought to be. That fact has been demonstrated perhaps most terribly in the 20th century. In 1939, after the Spanish Civil War, and as World War threatened, H.G. Wells wrote this: "The spectacle of evil in the world, the wanton destruction of homes, the cold-blooded massacres and mutilations, the rapes and filthy humiliations, and above all, a return of deliberate and organized torture, mental torment and fear, has come near to breaking my spirit altogether." And apart from God's intervention, we have no reasonable hope that the 21st century will treat us more lightly. Nor is nature spared. It suffers alongside us. Natural disasters and pain and disease and untimely death throw a dark shadow over this beautiful world. But what exactly is sin and evil? How did it come into being? How did it enter our world? Evil exists because of sin. Sin isn't just a force. Sin is a relational, personal thing. At root, sin is the rebellion of a personal being against the personal God. So only personal beings, humans and angels, are capable of sinning. Genesis chapter 3 tells us how Adam and Eve rebelled against God. But they weren't the first rebels. They were tempted by a wily serpent. That serpent was at least a mouthpiece for Satan. It may perhaps have been Satan himself in disguise. Satan was already God's enemy before he tempted mankind. Satan was the very first sinner. But Satan wasn't always evil. Satan was created by God, and our good God cannot create evil creatures. Satan was originally a perfect, sinless being. So there must have come a time when Satan rebelled against God. Two remarkable Old Testament passages may help us here. These passages are Isaiah 14, verses 12 to 15, and Ezekiel 28, verses 11 to 19. The first passage is part of a prophecy against the king of Babylon. The king here probably refers to the Babylonian monarchy or empire. The other passage laments the fall of the king of Tyre. Babylon and the king of Tyre were proud. They reflected Satan's own pride. Many Christians think that these passages and Isaiah and Ezekiel have a double reference. They think that they also refer to Satan, as well as to Babylon and the king of Tyre. If this is true, what do these passages tell us about Satan? They paint a picture of a glorious angel who originally lived in God's heavenly home. Satan had great power and status. But Satan became proud. In fact, in his first letter to Timothy, Paul implies that. Satan even seems to have aspired to be like God himself. This was high treason. God threw him out of heaven. Other angels joined Satan's rebellion. They too were cast out of heaven. Satan then set up his own dark kingdom in another heavenly realm. Here Satan established his headquarters. From this heavenly realm, he and his evil forces oppose God and every angel and human loyal to him. This cosmic conflict is central to the Bible story. So what is Satan like? The name Satan is a Hebrew word. It basically means adversary. In the New Testament, Satan is often called the diabolos, meaning the slanderer or the accuser. Satan is the great adversary, the great accuser. He slanders God, he slanders God's people as well. He hates anything that belongs to God or that reminds him of God. Satan is also called the evil one. In his book entitled 18 Words, J.I. Packer writes that Satan and his forces of evil are of quite unimaginable badness, more cruel, more malicious, more proud, more scornful, more perverted, more destructive, more disgusting, more filthy, more despicable than anything our minds can conceive. Satan's key weapon is deception. He began his earthly campaign by deceiving Eve. John the Apostle described Satan as the deceiver of the whole world. And one of the chief ways in which Satan deceives is imitation. In fact, it seems that he wants to imitate God himself, to be like the Most High. He wants to do the things that God does. We must remember, however, that Satan is only an angel. God is omnipotent, omnipresent, that is, present everywhere at once, and omniscient, that is, knowing everything. Satan is none of these things. He doesn't know everything, he can't be everywhere at once, and his power, though great, is limited. Under Satan's control are a host of evil beings. Ephesians 6, verse 12, refers to the rulers, the authorities, the cosmic powers over this present darkness, the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. The plurality of terms suggests that there may be different functions and ranks of evil being. The New Testament also mentions demons. They are also called unclean spirits and evil spirits. Demons have a craving to live in a physical body. They may be a kind of fallen angel, or there may be another type of evil being. In an earlier talk, we saw that the Garden of Eden was God's sanctuary. It was a place where God dwelt on earth. Here, in this paradise, God walked with Adam and Eve. God and mankind enjoyed fellowship together. God commanded Adam to work and guard the Garden of Eden. That included protecting it from unwelcome intruders. The Garden of Eden was God's home here on earth. Satan doubtless now saw his chance to do on earth what he'd failed to do in heaven. It seems he wanted to be like God in heaven, but God cast him out. Now Satan saw his chance to be like God on earth. He saw his chance to rule earth as if he were God. But first he had to deal with the ones God had appointed to guard the garden, Adam and Eve. He had to get them on his side. How long Adam and Eve lived in blissful fellowship with God we're not told, but there came a day when Satan made his move. He gatecrashed his way into the garden. Adam and Eve now had to stand firm and repulse Satan's assault. That assault focused on a tree, the tree of a knowledge of good and evil. This was one of two special trees in the garden. The other was the tree of life. God forbade Adam and Eve from eating from a tree of a knowledge of good and evil. Why? Because eating from this tree would have been an act of independence from God. To eat from this tree was to say to God, in effect, I know better than God. From now on, I'll decide for myself what's good and what's bad. God said to Adam that he would surely die if he ate from the forbidden tree, but he gave no further explanation. Why did he plant the tree there in the first place? And how come eating its fruit would result in death? God didn't say. Adam and Eve simply had to trust that God had their best interests at heart. They just had to obey him, even though they didn't know exactly why. In short, they had to live by faith, not by sight. Right through the Bible, we see God looking for and rewarding faith in him. By planting the tree of a knowledge of good and evil in the garden, God was giving Adam and Eve a choice. Would they love and trust and obey him, or would they reject God's authority and decide for themselves how to live? God laid that choice before Adam and Eve. He lays that choice before each one of us, too. Satan targets Eve. He enchants her by his exquisite beauty and subtle charm. The serpent was at least Satan's mouthpiece. He may, in fact, have been Satan himself in disguise. Ever the deceiver, Satan hid his true identity. But where was Adam while the serpent was tempting Eve? Very likely he was with her. The commentator Kenneth Matthews points out that the pronoun you at each place in Genesis 3 verses 1 through 5 is plural and thus suggests Adam's presence. Observe how subtly Satan seduces Eve to sin. He says to her, "Did God actually say, 'You shall not eat of any tree in the garden?'" He invites her to question what God has said. And notice the touch of surprise, even incredulity. Did God actually say? Satan focuses Eve's mind on God's one restriction rather than his generosity. God said, "You may surely eat of every tree of the garden." But Satan says, "You shall not eat of any tree in the garden." He misquotes God. He portrays God as a stingy oppressor rather than a generous provider. God had given Adam and Eve authority over the animals. Here was an animal who was bringing God's character into question. Adam and Eve should have cast this animal, this serpent, out of a garden immediately. But they didn't. Eve seems caught off guard. She corrects the serpent, but not accurately. She replies, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but God had said, 'You may surely eat of every tree of the garden.'" Eve omits the words "surely" and "every." In so doing, she downplays God's liberal generosity. And she says that they weren't even to touch the fruit, making God's command stricter than it actually was. Adam, it seems, remains in the background, passively observing what was going on. Then Satan comes straight out with it. We can paraphrase and amplify his words recorded in Genesis 3 verses 4 and 5 thus. "You won't really die. God is lying to you. God has got something wonderful, but he doesn't want to share it with you. He's got freedom, freedom to do exactly as he pleases. But he doesn't want you to be free. He doesn't want you to enjoy life to the full. Break with him and go eat from that tree. Choose for yourself what's good for you and what's bad for you. Only then will you have a life that's really worth living." It sounds so blasphemous because it is so blasphemous. Satan slandered God to Eve. Satan pretended to be her friend. He portrayed God as her rival. He made Adam and Eve think wrongly about God, something he tries to do to all of us. Satan wants us to think that God doesn't love us, that God hasn't got our best interests at heart. Eve gazed at the fruit. She sensed how luscious it was. She saw how captivatingly lovely it was to look at. She took the fruit and ate. Then she gave some to Adam. He ate with her. Sin entered our race. Eve was deceived. But Adam was not deceived. His sin constituted complete moral failure. God's graciousness and generosity were obvious to Adam. All he had to do was to look around him at the bountiful garden and his beautiful wife. But Adam chose to believe Satan instead. Adam was fully aware of what he was doing. Adam was the first human being, and so he was God's appointed head of the human race. As humanity's head, God held Adam ultimately responsible for that first sin. Notice that Adam and Eve's rebellion against God was based on what they believed. What they believed was profoundly untrue. Firstly, they believed Satan's lies about God. But they also believed Satan's lies about themselves, too. Adam and Eve had, in Ian Thomas's words, believed the devil's lie, that man can somehow be man without God, that we can carve our own destiny, be king in our own kingdom, be our own God. Through Satan's lying subtlety, mankind embarked upon the mad experiment of disobedience and human self-sufficiency. Adam and Eve's encounter with Satan took place in a garden. Later in the Bible, we encounter another garden. It was called Gethsemane. In the Garden of Eden, Adam said to God, in effect, "I won't do what you want, I'll do what I want." In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus said to God, "I will do what you want, not what I want." The first Adam rebelled. Jesus, the second Adam, obeyed. He submitted himself to his Father and to death on the cross. And on the cross he saves all those who believe in him from all the consequences of the first Adam's sin, as we shall see in a later talk. What exactly is sin? It's not only thinking evil thoughts or doing evil things. Those are just the symptoms. Sin goes much, much deeper than that. Michael Reeves explains, "Our problem is not so much that we have behaved wrongly, but that we have been drawn to love wrongly." As we saw in a previous talk, at the very heart of our human nature is a capacity for love. We humans were made to love God and to love each other. That's why Jesus said, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And a second is like it, you shall love your neighbour as yourself." So what went wrong? Instead of loving God, Adam and Eve turned away from him and began to love themselves. They themselves and what they themselves wanted became the most important thing to them. In so doing, they dethroned God from his rightful place in their lives. It was an act of mutiny. Sinners are traitors, guilty of high treason against their Creator and King. Adam's one sin defiled the entire human race. Only Jesus was exempt from its effects. In Romans 5, verse 12, Paul tells us, "Therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned." Paul says that we all sinned. Does he simply mean that we've all committed sins? Of course we have. But Paul means more than that. So what does Paul mean? Remember that the human race isn't just a group of unrelated individuals. It's a family. Paul says that God made from one man every nation of mankind. We're all connected to the first man, Adam. So when Adam committed the first sin, all of us were somehow, in some mysterious way we cannot fully explain, implicated in his sin. In our next talk, we'll look at all the consequences of sin, and we'll see what God needed to do to put everything right. That sets the scene for the whole of the rest of the Bible story.